Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with Wealth Formula Podcast. And today I'm back in my office, which is a big relief. I was running from the fires, the Thomas fires in Ventura, and then they kind of spread up north here to Santa Barbara and Montecito area. And about 2 weeks ago, we woke up, and as I mentioned before, the smoke alarm was going off, but there was no fire. There was ash on the deck, and I decided we better get out of here. So there was no fire. We couldn't see any fire, but we, you know, this air quality was really bad. And again, there was ash and stuff. So we decided let's head up north. So, for a few days, ride this thing out. Well, that few days ended up being 1 week and then two. And the next thing is, so it was a total of about 14 days. We were gone and ended up spending some time up in Santa Cruz, where my wife is from, and finally made it back. And it is nice to be back. There's a little bit of ash here and there. My car was covered with ash. But other than that, everything's fine and back to normal. So just grateful to be back. Hey, by the way, I got various presents from people, gifts and things for the holidays from some of the listeners. And I do appreciate that. You don't really need to do it. But it's I'm touched. Okay, so thank you for that. You know, let's start like we always do with the show. Let's talk a little bit about what you are missing out on WealthFormula.com. WealthFormula.com, as you know, is the home of the Wealth Formula Podcast. Tons of resources there. Make sure you check them out. You can get a free copy of Seven Secrets of Eternal Wealth in the PDF form. Now, this was my best-selling book that was on Amazon. It's still there. You can get it if you want, or you can just download it for free. You can also get a copy by simply texting 44222 and typing Wealth Formula, one word. Also, don't forget, we had this great webinar last week talking about American homeowner preservation. George Newberry and American Homeowner Preservation, who is one of our sponsors on the show. And George was doing a webinar for this raise that they're doing. This is the last fund that they're going to do 12% on. So I would definitely get in there as soon as possible. I think they're going down to 10%. And so I highly recommend, if you have been thinking about it, to at least go and check it out, ahpfunding.com. I am in this current fund that he's raising for myself. And I am not giving you financial advice, but I will tell you that I am a big fan of this business. So go check it out. This is a business that basically buys failing mortgages for pennies on the dollar from big banks, hedge funds, turns around and keeps people in their home with renegotiated terms, mortgages. Everybody wins. And right now you get 12%, but not for long. So check it out. As far as the topic for today, let me start out by taking you way back. Let's take you back about 450 some years ago. And it was in 1593 where there was a Dutch botanist by the name of Carolus Clusius, which I'm not sure if I pronounced that name right, but that's the way it looks like it's said. Well, anyway, he was a botanist and planted several tulip bulbs in his botanical garden. And over time, he proved that there was an incredible ability for these things to grow in harsh conditions such as those in the Low Countries. Now, tulips at this point were new to Europe. They'd been in sort of the Ottoman Empire, and they were introduced to the Dutch by the Holy Roman Empire, and they'd seen nothing like them. I mean, these were plants that were nothing like those that were in the Netherlands at the time. And furthermore, there was a virus, so called a mosaic virus, that the tulips infected with made them even more extraordinary. You see, these particular tulips, the ones infected with the mosaic virus, they took on this incredible flame-like appearance, and people were seriously wooed by them. The problem was that they took several years, sometimes over a decade, to cultivate. And, you know, the Dutch people were enthralled with these tulips. And the novelty and the scarcity of these tulips turned them into status symbols. And at the time, there was a growing Dutch middle class. They had just gotten independence from the Spanish. There was lots of prosperity in the street. And just like most new money, they wanted to show it, right? So they weren't buying fast cars. They were buying tulips. And of course, because of the scarcity and because of the demand, you might imagine, the price of tulips skyrocketed. And soon, the price of tulips became clearly excessive. And at the peak of what became known as tulip mania in February 1637, some single tulip bulb sold for more than 10 to 15 times the salary of the average craftsman. More than the price of the typical Dutch home. I mean, seriously, this was a massive hysteria. People were flipping tulips, you know, like they were flipping. They were buying them. They were just hoping that they'd go up in price, and then they'd sell them. And because the appreciating markets, you know, they were able to do this for a while. And because of these massively appreciating markets, there was even a futures market for tulips. And that drove prices even higher. And the future markets happened, frankly, because, you know, these things took so long to cultivate, people were willing to pay for them ahead of time to make sure they got them. And then, of course, one day in February of 1637, a tulip auction failed to attract any buyers. Nobody showed up. And it isn't clear exactly why, although some speculate that the bubonic plague kept most people home that day. At any rate, the merchants with tulips were thrown into a panic, which resulted in a massive sell-off. In short order, these tulips, these things that had just incredible value, I mean, people were buying acres and acres of land with them, became worthless. And so now, these days, in modern times, now every time you hear about a wild speculative market that seems to be irrational, people bring up what they call tulip mania, right? You hear it all the time. There's probably people talking about tulip mania who have no idea what they're talking about, but this is what it's about. So here's the question. It's been coming up a lot. Is cryptocurrency the new tulip mania? A lot of people seem to think so, including really smart people. I mean, people I trust, like, say, Jim Rickards. But there are others, like Tika Tiwari, who doesn't think so. Now, Tika is a very interesting guy. I really like this guy a lot. He's a former hedge fund guy who's become one of the most vocal proponents of cryptocurrency in the mainstream. And he is my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast this week. So when we come back, Tika Tiwari.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, I'm really excited. I've got a phenomenal guest. My guest is Tika Tiwari. Now, Tika is the co-editor of the Palm Beach Letter and Palm Beach Confidential in particular, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. He's got a really fascinating story, right? So he's a guy who started out in a foster care system as a kid in the United Kingdom, came to the U.S. In his teens with just a few bucks in his pocket. And by 18, he was the youngest employee at Lehman Brothers. And just a couple years later, he became the youngest vice president in the history of Schertz and Lehman. So that was very impressive. He went on to become more of a traditional Wall Street hedge fund manager and is now retired in that capacity. And these days, he is actually one of the most recognized faces in the cryptocurrency world, certainly from the mainstream looking in. Tika has been a contributor to Fox Business Network. He's appeared on Fox News Channel, CNBC, and ABC's Nightline. Tika, welcome to Wealth Formula Podcast.
Thank you, Buck. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invite.
You bet. Now, I'm excited to talk to you, man, because I am, I've found sort of a lot of interest myself in this area of cryptocurrency. Now, you know, in terms of your background, how'd you go from being a traditional Wall Street guy and then shift into this crypto world? What got you interested? When did you get in?
It's a great question. I first was exposed to Bitcoin around 2011. And like many people, really just thought it was a Ponzi scheme. It didn't make any sense. It didn't have any value. And, you know, I come from a very traditional Wall Street background. You know, we use valuation metrics in order to determine what a company is worth. Or what an industry is worth. And Bitcoin just, it's a brand new asset that doesn't have the typical metrics that you would look for. So I automatically assumed, like many people still assume, that Bitcoin was nothing more than a Ponzi scheme designed to enrich early adopters. So I ignored Bitcoin. And then a funny thing happened. I saw Bitcoin go to around $1,200 and then collapse. And I had expected the collapse. But what I have learned, Buck, is that when something collapses due to being a fraud, it goes to zero, right? It has absolutely no value. But Bitcoin, even after it had collapsed more than 85%, was still worth billions of dollars and was still being traded. And that intrigued me. It interested me, and it gave me the first inkling that I might have been wrong in my initial assumption that Bitcoin was nothing more than a Ponzi scheme. And so I started doing a tremendous amount of research. I started traveling all over the world, attending Bitcoin events and talking to Bitcoin people. And I finally grasped what made Bitcoin so valuable. And it had to do with the underlying technology behind Bitcoin, the blockchain, which enables you and I to transact with one another without relying on a centralized third party or a trusted third party. It also allows us to possess wealth that no other human being can steal from us. So long as we keep our private key, which is essentially our password, safe, no one can compel you, me, or anyone else to give up that wealth. And that's never existed before, Buck. Even from the days of cavemen, right? The stronger man could always take wealth or food, which was wealth back then, from the weaker man. And then throughout history, we've obviously seen, you know, kings and governments really abuse their power of stealing the assets or the buying power of its citizens. And here was an asset class that was absolutely safe from any malicious third party that would want to take it. And that, to me, showed that there was just tremendous value here in this digital asset.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've said this before. I think it's a very interesting space where there's a confluence of libertarian thought and ultimately computer geeks, right? I mean, that's a powerful mix. One question I have is I've heard, I met you at the Cambridge conference in San Francisco with Jim Rickards and all that. And, you know, you hear a lot of people down on currencies in general, but it's always referred to by a lot of the folks still as a fiat currency. And in some respects, to me, it doesn't quite fit the measure of a fiat currency. Is it a fiat currency or not?
Doug Casey considers it a form of a fiat currency. I do not consider it to be a fiat currency. Fiat currencies have nothing to back them, right? The U.S. dollar just has a promise to pay. So as opposed to Bitcoin is backed by cryptography, and it's backed by mathematical law and mathematical proofs. There can't be more than 21 million Bitcoin in place. It costs an enormous amount of money to generate even a single Bitcoin. And there's an ongoing cost for maintaining the Bitcoin network. The Bitcoin network, you know, people really don't understand how valuable that is. It's a global network that allows you to – it's both a payment network, a settlement network, a remittance network, and a completely distributed secure network all in one, right? And so that's incredibly valuable. So just as gold has inherent value given the fact that it's limited and that it costs a lot of money to dig it up out of the ground, I believe that many of those principles can translate to this what I believe is a digital version of gold, and that is Bitcoin.
Yeah, and to your point, I've said it before, but I personally, when I look at this, and I'm certainly no expert in this area, but to me, Bitcoin in particular has more qualities similar to gold than the American dollar. Maybe I'm being a little bold to say that to this audience, but I really believe that. Now, as of this moment, we're over 16,000.
That's right.
And it's funny because, you know, people are like, oh, gold, you know, the Bitcoin could go to 25,000 by next year. It could, by next week, it could go to 25,000, right? And of course, you know, going back to this conference, you have people left and right calling this the biggest bubble since the tulip bubble of the Dutch golden age. Are they right?
No, they're completely wrong. And they're confusing what's called S-curve adoption with a bubble. So if you look at a chart of Bitcoin, just going back a year, Bitcoin has these massive spikes and then has these massive pullbacks. And then during every pullback, you see thousands of articles. See, we told you it was a bubble. See, we told you it was a bubble. And then it inflates again, and you know, they kind of scurry off, and then it comes in again. So what we will continue to see, Buck, is relentless volatility, but also a relentless uptrend, right? We are in a secular bull market for Bitcoin. It doesn't mean that we're going to go up in a straight line. This year, I've had to live through three massive pullbacks, anywhere in the range of 40 to 60%, right? That's very difficult. I mean, if the stock market pulled back 40, 50, and 60%, right, had three of those pullbacks in a one-year period, I mean, people will be jumping off out of buildings. So this is the nature of Bitcoin. You have to recognize the fact that it is incredibly volatile, but that's just the nature of the asset class. As it becomes bigger, you will see that the volatility will tamp down. And that's certainly been true if you look at the early days of the volatility of Bitcoin to now. I will say that, you know, I've been recommending Bitcoin since it was $400 2 years ago, and we haven't sold any. We think there's quite a bit more upside up ahead of us.
Yeah. And to the point of volatility decreasing as others get involved, you know, obviously right now you've got Bitcoin futures, I think maybe are the official now, or they were going to be very soon. What impact does that have? Is this, in some regards, it seems to me like this is just the beginning. I mean, the institutional money is just starting to get in. Am I right?
Yeah, I was in New York City the week before last attending Consensus Invest, which is an event specifically geared towards institutions. And I was floored at the level of institutional interest in Bitcoin. I met with one of the largest creators of derivatives in the world, and he is just licking his chops, getting ready to get his clients involved in Bitcoin derivatives. Now, I will say that having a paper market, which is what derivatives are versus the physical market, is going to create a lot of volatility, probably more volatility than we've dealt with in the past. But I see this as just part of Bitcoin's maturing process. I mean, 2 years ago, the narrative was Bitcoin was only used by child pornographers and by terrorists and by drug dealers. And, you know, nobody on Wall Street wanted anything to do with Bitcoin. But here we are 2 years later, and now people are realizing, yes, just like any technology, it's very often adopted by criminals. But there are also uses for the technology far and above any criminal uses. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing institutions start looking at it, and also just plain greed, Buck. They've seen this asset class explode in price, and they want a piece of the action.
Yeah, they'd be in on tulips again if they came back in fashion, right?
I'd say there would be tulip futures if tulips were gunning this high, yes.
Right, right.
So I would just say this is very important that, you know, Bitcoin does get ahead of itself from time to time, just like any asset class. And I would suggest that anybody looking at Bitcoin really view it as a long-term investment and really not risk anything more than you'd be prepared to lose. Because if you put more in than that, Buck, what happens is that during the down cycles of volatility, you get scared and you end up selling out at the bottom of the price cycle and then watching it go back up.
Yeah.
So the key is don't allocate any more capital than this than you're willing to lose, and that you're willing to deal with massive volatility. Like, you could put money in tomorrow and it could be down 50% 2 days later, and then up 100%, you know, 2 months after that. That is just the nature of Bitcoin, and you have to be emotionally and mentally prepared for that.
You know, there is a lot of these other, you know, we talk about Bitcoin, right? But, you know, there's literally thousands of currencies now. Probably most of them are not probably not worth even what they're selling for at a few cents. But there are a lot of very quality ones, too, like Ethereum, et cetera. And you don't really hear about this stuff very much. I mean, what is it uniquely about Bitcoin versus these other currencies, namely, say, Ethereum or Ripple, that make it is it just the first, you know, that they're the first in line?
It's the first mover advantage is certainly part of it. It's the name that everybody knows. But also, the Bitcoin network is the most secure blockchain in the world. People have been attacking the Bitcoin network every day for 10 years, and they have never been able to knock it offline. They have never been able to distort that blockchain. And people get confused and say, well, wasn't Bitcoin hacked? No, Bitcoin's never been hacked, but exchanges have been hacked. People's wallets have been hacked. But the actual blockchain itself, the sanctity of the ledger, has never been violated. And maybe if folks are new, they're not exactly sure what blockchain is, but perhaps you'd want me to explain that real quick.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So a blockchain is actually quite simple. It's just a ledger that is shared. So the same way when you go to the bank, Buck, and you draw some money out of your bank, and then you go to the ATM of another bank, the other bank has this shared ledger with your bank, and they say, well, you know, Buck took out $100, so, you know, we know he can't take out that $100 again, right? You can't double spend that money. And so banks have a shared ledger right now. The problem is with banks is that banks have a history of lying. And they will go back and they will manipulate that ledger or manipulate that information. Plus, that ledger, we can never see it. It can only be seen by this kind of inside cartel. So a blockchain is different in that it is a public ledger. Everybody can see every single transaction. And what makes the blockchain special, there are two things that make it special. One is once data has been written into a blockchain, It cannot be tampered with. It cannot be rewritten. It cannot be changed. And the other thing is that when new data is added to the blockchain, in order to prevent double spending, right, so spending the same $100 twice, all the nodes in the network, they look at this shared copy of the ledger. And so if I'm now trying to spend Bitcoin that I've spent before, the network will look at all the other copies of the ledger and say, well, hold on, Tico's trying to spend Bitcoin he doesn't have. And it will reject me doing that. And it does it automatically. And so in order for new information to be added to the network, 51% of the computers have to agree, yes, this is a valid transaction. And that's called reaching consensus. And it's this magical way of moving data that creates a network that does not rely on a trusted third party. We do not have to rely on a bank saying, yes, this transaction is accurate, this transaction isn't accurate. It is a self-functioning network that has no leadership. And that has never happened before. It's what makes Bitcoin so powerful, that there's no central Bitcoin headquarters. I see people all the time email me saying, oh, what if they shut Bitcoin down? Well, you know, you can't shut Bitcoin down. There's over 5,000 nodes. You'd have to shut down the entire internet to kill Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So
that's terrorism or something like that, right?
Well, I don't like to draw the parallel of terrorism and Bitcoin. I know Jim Rickards does.
Right.
It's a very robust network that is very strong and for all intents and purposes is hack-proof.
Right. So speaking of Jim brought up the idea that blockchain competitors, namely, I think IBM has a product like Hyperledger or something like that.
Hyperledger Fabric.
From what I hear, you know, Hyperledger is not really not the same level of security of blockchain. Are there other, I mean, I don't know what your thoughts on that are. I mean, there are others out there in their infancy, like I know Swirlwinds has something called Hashgraph that they're looking into that I've been interested in. What is there a possibility that you see on the horizon in reality of replacing blockchain with a different kind of consensus mechanism?
Well, there's different takes on blockchain, right? So a blockchain essentially just means you're using this distributed ledger technology. And so the banks call it DLT. They don't like to use the word blockchain. And there's different ways of creating security on a blockchain. And I won't go into a deep dive on it because I don't want to put your audience to sleep.
Yeah. I'll be interested.
So. In Bitcoin, they use something called proof of work. And then in other networks, they use something called proof of stake. And so there are different ways of securing the blockchain. And so I think you need to look at it, the difference between Apple and Google and Microsoft and Amazon, right? They all do different things, but they're in the technology space. Just because there's Apple doesn't mean I can't buy Google, right? Doesn't mean I can't own shares in either one of them. So each one of these projects are attacking a different sector of the market. So it's not as binary as this one will kill that one or this one can't survive if this one wins.
Right.
Right. It's a lot bigger than that.
Rickards brought up the point, the one thing that he and I'm using him just as the devil's advocate myself, sure. Because I'm generally kind of on your brain wavelength on this.
Well, let's talk about money laundering for a second, because he was making a big point that Bitcoin is this, you know, refuge of money launderers. So let's put this in perspective. We have some of the most onerous AML rules in the world. AML stands for anti-money laundering, and yet it's estimated that $3 trillion a year is laundered, right? AML does not work. Our AML rules do not work. And up until recently, the entire Bitcoin network was only 150 billion. It's bigger now because it's moved up as much. So I think we're at $250 billion right now for the entire market cap of Bitcoin versus $3 trillion a year that are laundered globally that we know of. So I would say Bitcoin is not big enough for money launderers to really use in size. It's too small relative to the cash market. And two, Bitcoin is only pseudo-anonymous, right? So what that means is, yes, all the addresses have an anonymous number attached to them. They don't have your name attached to them. But every single transaction that you do that involves Bitcoin is tracked on the public blockchain. So you only need to get tied. Your identity only needs to get tied to one transaction, and a forensic accountant can unravel every single transaction you've done in Bitcoin. So money launderers actually are not only maybe the dumb ones are using Bitcoin.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
The smart ones are using not cash, using right? a blockchain technology
right.
To launder money. It's really a very stupid idea to use a blockchain to launder money.
Let's talk a little bit about the concept of coins, okay? Because I think this is a very confusing thing for people, and frankly, for myself too, as somebody who's already, you know, sort of feels like I'm way ahead of most people in this. You know, there's, as we've talked about, there's a number of other cryptocurrencies out there, like, say, Ripple, which, you know, for example, is something that a lot of the banks are starting to use, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then you've got even Ethereum, where there's a big role for smart contracts, et cetera. What does a coin even mean in these technologies? Because there seems to be this sort of balance there that I'm trying to understand, where it's a coin versus a technology or a business. Where does the coin come in?
Yeah, so I think a coin is just a simple term we use that we can understand. I would say the more appropriate term would be cryptographic token, or token for short. And so this is a distinction I'd like to make for your audience, that when everybody talks about crypto, they will invariably say cryptocurrency. And I want to make it clear that not every crypto asset is a cryptocurrency. Crypto assets generally fall into two different types of use cases. One is a cryptocurrency, which is a cryptographic token that is attempting to become a substitute for fiat currency. So Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, we can say, are cryptocurrencies. And then there are things called utility coins or utility tokens. And these are tokens that are used either in the creation or the delivery of a particular service. And so I'll give you an example of that. The Ethereum network. Ethereum is probably it's the one that most people know other than Bitcoin. It's the second largest market cap coin in the world. And so what Ethereum is, Buck, it's a global computer that you can develop on. And any application you put on the Ethereum network cannot be shut down by any government. And it's a blockchain application that you can build it's a blockchain platform that you can build blockchain applications on. So the same way that people build applications for the Apple iOS or for the Microsoft operating system, think of Ethereum as a development platform, right? So this allows me to build an application without having to build out an underlying blockchain infrastructure. And so the currency for buying computer power on the Ethereum network is a token called Ether, right? So if you want to build an application on top of Ethereum, you have to buy the Ether token to buy computational time on this network. So every time you do a computation, you have to pay a fraction of an Ether. And so this creates demand for the Ether token, which is why Ether is very clearly a utility token. Can look at it like it's the gas needed to run the computer programs on this particular network. Does that distinction make sense between utility coins and cryptocurrency?
It does, and I think it also helps me understand for once why it makes sense for Ethereum to go up in value because as people need, I mean, they have a slightly different system where it sounds like there really isn't, you know, a limit of Ethereum, which potentially could be a problem. But as the need for that continues or the demand, then that's what creates the increased value in the token. Is that
it
fair?
Creates increased, yeah, it creates the increased value in the token, and any ether that you use to power your contract gets burned. So it gets destroyed.
Right. And that probably also explains why so many of these ICOs, these initial coin offerings, as they're called, are Ethereum-driven.
Well, they're Ethereum-driven because of something called the ERC-20 protocol, which makes it very easy for you to issue a coin under this protocol, and it makes the storage of the coin or the token very simple. That's why the Ethereum network has so much value right now, because it's very easy to launch a new token on that network. And of course, Ethereum was the first to create smart contracts, which have profound implications for the future of business.
In terms of, you know, just complete misunderstandings, and I'm going to go back to this again because, you know, this stuff is getting attacked left and right, and you are admirably defending the space from, you know, the likes of Jim Rickards, and well, I think Doug Casey was even, you know, he wasn't.
He's a bull.
He's a bull.
He sees this more as a trading opportunity, I think, rather than systemic change in the way that, you know, business is done.
Yeah.
Whereas I view this as we are at the birth of a brand new industrial revolution.
Right. So along that lines, like, what do you think the misunderstanding is? Most frequently amongst people like Rickards and stuff that you would take this opportunity maybe just to clear up as people hear this argument over and over in podcasts like mine.
Well,
from him.
I would say that it comes back down to the internet. In the early 90s, very smart people said the internet was dumb, was stupid. It was just, even back then, most of the internet postings were people talking about their cat and putting up pictures of their cat. And there was no scaling back then, right? The internet was incredibly slow. So folks would look at that and say, rather than looking at where that technology curve was going, they were looking at where the technology was in that moment, which was essentially cat pictures, pornography, and really slow download times. And they couldn't see beyond that. And they said, oh, you know, this is ludicrous. This will never scale. The technology doesn't exist for millions of people to be using this at the same time. This is a complete waste of time. Even Bill Gates, you know, basically came out and said that the internet was dumb.
Yeah.
So there's just what happens is as you get older, you have this frame of reference that you work from, and it works for you until it doesn't, right?
Yeah.
And so every 15 or 20 years or so, everything changes, right? The paradigm changes, and your old frame of reference no longer has value. But we are so emotionally and mentally attached to the way that we view the world because it's worked for us. And especially if you're wealthy, it's worked for you. The way that you view the world has worked for you. But there are times, Buck, when you have to be willing to sacrifice all you think you know in order to embrace a new idea so you don't get left behind. And that's the beauty of youth, right? Youth is not encumbered by this old frame of reference. It can see a different world. And that's why it's the young that pave the way forward in technology.
You know, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I am 44. So, I mean, I've seen some cycles. Most of that life has been spent in school broke for me. So I haven't had money, but on the other hand, you know, I was in college right around the .com era. My wife was at Stanford when, you know, the whole thing went, you know, they were doing 18-year-old millionaire, you know, parties in San Francisco left and right. And when I look back on that and I look at these things that, you know, I could have potentially been part of at the very early, in its infancy, I regret that, right? To me, I'm looking at this saying, you know what? This could take a crazy ride and it probably will have huge ups and downs. But not having exposure to this, I think would create some significant regret for me personally in the future. Do you hear that often?
Yeah, I mean, that's for the last 2 years, I have been traveling around the world with a simple message. Own, even if you think I'm crazy, own a little bit of Bitcoin. Because if I'm right, you will experience regret like you can't imagine.
Like Amazon trading at $5 or something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what I guess one last question for you, which is, okay, so you're very bullish. I'm bullish. You know, we just talked about $16,000 Bitcoin as of today.
Yeah.
At what point does Tika Tiwari say, I'm selling? You know, I mean, what has to happen? What, you know, obviously we were looking at this and you say, this is going to go to, in my mind, it's going to 100, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Where do you look at it and say, it's time to sell? What has to happen for you?
I look at the adoption of, I look at two things, right? I look at awareness of Bitcoin versus adoption of Bitcoin. And I talked about this briefly when I was in San Francisco. Right now, the awareness of Bitcoin is up quite dramatically, especially over the last 2 months. But if you actually ask people, hey, do you own Bitcoin? You know, 95 out of 100 are going to say no. So the adoption of Bitcoin is still very low, Buck.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm looking for is for the adoption of Bitcoin to come up to the awareness of Bitcoin. And so when adoption of Bitcoin and awareness of Bitcoin reach, that's going to be when I'll think about taking some money off the table. Mm-hmm. Until then, I would have done all of my readers a disservice by selling too early.
Sure, that makes sense. So, Tika, tell us, you know, I know you have lots of ways we can learn more about you and about what's going on, but tell us about some of the ways that we can get information from you.
Yeah, I work for a company called Palm Beach Research Group. Their URL is palmbeachgroup.com. And probably what I'm most famous for is writing a newsletter called Palm Beach Confidential, which is all about cryptocurrency. And it's the oldest newsletter in the space. It has the best track record in the space. That's actually closed right now for new members. We've had a huge influx of new members, and we're focusing right now just on taking care of those members. We will reopen sometime next year. And if you're interested in finding out about that, you can go to join Big T, and Big T is Big T is a nickname I used to have on Wall Street. I used to weigh well over 300 pounds.
Wow. And but you're so, a big guy. What are you, like 6'3 or so?
I'm 6'2. So Big T kind of stuck, and a lot of my friends still call me Big T.
Got it.
So that website, joinbigt.com, and you'll be able to just enter your email in there and join our wait list, and we'll let you know when the service opens up again.
And I will certainly make an announcement, send out an email when I find out, too. And I am actually a Palm Beach Confidential reader myself, and I enjoy that very much. Tika, thank you so much for being on Wealth Formula Podcast today.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
We'll be right back.
Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Now, what do you think? Is this cryptomania? Is this just tulip mania, like Jim Rickards thinks? Well, here's my take. Okay, there's obviously massive speculation going on in this space right now, and most coins and ICOs will—they're just not going to be around in the next 5 years. I mean, that is
I think that's pretty easy to guess. There's just too much stuff out there, too much hysteria for things that are not clearly of enterprise value. And there may even be a massive correction in the price of Bitcoin and some of the more prominent coins. But make no mistake, okay, distributed ledger technology is here to stay. Now, why do I say that? Well, let's go back a little bit. Let's go back a couple of decades. Was there a dot-com bubble in the 90s? Of course there was. Did people lose a lot of money speculating? Of course they did. But was there real value in this whole internet thing? Yes, there was. And people who invested in some companies that went on to do some great things really came out making a killing, right? People who invested in Google, people who invested in Amazon early on made fortunes regardless of what happened in the dot-com bubble. And what I'm here to tell you is that similarly, distributed ledger technology, okay, blockchain, all this, it's real. And it has real-world value that will fundamentally change not only technology, but also the way we do business. And you know what? You can't say that about tulips. This is not a tulip mania. And certainly there may be a massive correction, like I said, but when the dust settles, mark my word, this revolution, this technological revolution, will probably result in the world's first trillionaire. And there's no question in my mind that tremendous amounts of wealth will be made by people who are not seeing this as a passing fad. Now, if you think I'm wrong, tell me why, because I haven't figured out why. And you know, I'm not Mr. Speculation Guy. That's not what I am. I'm seeing a rising technology here that, just like the internet, you know, sort of passed people by, passed investors by, who looked back and said, gosh, I wish I knew, I wish I noticed that when it was emerging. That's where we are with this stuff, ladies and gentlemen. And I strongly urge you to pay attention. So my call to action to you today is simple, okay? And it's not go invest in this stuff. But if you don't understand what I'm talking about or what Tika and I talked about with distributed ledger technology, blockchain, Bitcoin, all this stuff, just go to Google and start, you know, just plug in Bitcoin, blockchain, whatever, and watch a bunch of videos. Actually, that's even easier. Don't even read about it. Just watch a bunch of videos over and over again until you start to get it. And then maybe you choose not to get involved. That's up to you. But at least give yourself the chance not to kick yourself for not noticing the next world-changing technology as it unfolds before your own eyes. Anyway, that's it for me this week. This is Buck Joffrey with Wealth Formula Podcast signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Save You with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at SaveYouPodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, SaveYouPodcast.com.